I am Allison Myers, and I affiliate with CLMP. And this panel, Publishing the Disabled Voice, is brought to you by CLMP, the Community of Literary Magazines and Presses, which is a national service organization for independent literary publishing. We have over 500 independent publishers, literary publishers, who are members across the country. We're situated in New York City, but we serve the nation. And this is our 50th anniversary year, and we invite you to learn more about the opportunities and programs delivered by CLMP at clmp.org. Please do check us out. There are opportunities for publishers and writers and readers. So just a note about how we're going to organize the panel today. As I said, it's a conversation. And to that end, I'm not going to wait until the end of the panel to invite your questions and comments. Instead, we'll pause at intervals, and I'll ask you to interact with our panelists here, as you will. I will repeat your question or comment into the mic because this is being recorded. So please know that this conversation is recorded if you choose to speak, and I hope you do. And similarly, I've asked our panelists to interact with one another. I do have questions prepared, but those are only meant to be jumping off points, and I hope you feel free to take the conversation where you will. So first, I'll begin by introducing our esteemed panelists. It's my privilege to be here today to help facilitate their conversation. Thereafter, they will read briefly from their work in this order: Stephanie Gray, C.S. Giscombe, and Jen Hyde. Stephanie Gray is a poet-filmmaker and adjunct professor at Pace University. Her poetry books and chapbooks include Shorthand and Electric Language Stars, a Lammy finalist, A Country Road Going Back in Your Direction, and Place Your Orders Now. C.S. Giscombe teaches English at the University of California, Berkeley, and is the author of many books of poetry and essays. His recent collections include Prairie Style, Ohio Railroads, and Border Towns. He is at work on a mixed-genre prose book, Railroad Sense, and Negro Mountain, a book of poems. He is a long-distance cyclist. Jen Hyde is the assistant poetry editor for Bellevue Literary Review, and author of Hua Xie Hua, Drawings and Poems from China. The recipient of a Margins Fellowship from the Asian American Writers Workshop, she is a collaborative chapbook publisher for No Dear Small Anchor and currently is at work on Murmur. Stephanie, I'll ask you to read first.
I'm going to read two poems, but both, can everyone hear me? Okay, I'm back, okay. One poem is from a chapbook I did a couple of years ago. I thought you said it was sound. How does the sound? And this did have to do with sound. I wasn't really thinking of hearing that, but it's how I experience sound as opposed to reading about it. I had a hearing loss. And then the other poem is from a brand new chapbook called Go Under the Surface, which is a bit going under the surface about communication and what we mean by like different slang terms and mannerisms, which if you have hearing loss, you rely on those contextual clues a lot. So I'll go ahead and start. Under the sound. There's actually some copies up here. Does anyone need a copy before I start? If that will help. You can grab one, don't be shy. Okay. Okay, there's one or two more. Okay. Under the sound. I thought we said, under the sound, we see a thought around. What we thought before that classic rock song came down. Beneath its meaning, so it matched up with the theory, up the road, down the street. That they told you to think what they said because said with the manhood, because they deserve saying. So it matched up with the theory, it's what I said, it's what they said, it's what someone said. What if I don't want to match up the sound below with the theory up there? What then, what, and then? And this next poem is called, I opened my mouth, but no sound came out. I opened my mouth, but no sound came out. Instead, nothing flew in. Maybe something was drawn in. I opened my mouth, but no sound came out. Instead, something blew in, but sneaked out as fast as it came. I opened my mouth, but no sound came out. Instead, something blew out. Not really a scream or a shout or something in between. I opened my mouth, but no sound came out. Instead, doubts blew in, bits of trash or fins. The ocean coming to get me in high tide. I opened my mouth, but no sound came out. Instead, consonants blew in, bits of vowels blew out, and diphthongs hid in the cavities. I opened my mouth, but no sound came out. Instead, grunge low tones of the 90s blew in, bits of growls or guitar buzz, and sopranos went extinct. I opened my mouth, but no sound came out. Instead, low value cards for my youth flew in, without the disapproval of those who said the low values were too low. I opened my mouth, but no sound came out. Instead, rain flew in, bits of blue clouds and blue collars, and white sky crawled out just when the sun turned the corner. I opened my mouth, but no eyes flew out. Instead, ears flew in, pieces of speakers or mints to make the cadences of your words sting. I opened my mouth, but no shapes came out. Instead, clouds flew in along with their din. If cotton candy made noise being scratched together. I opened my mouth, but no shapes came out. Instead, comets zapped out. Madonna said hi to me, sucks. I opened my ears, but no orchestras came out. Instead, classic rock blew in. 7 minute sorrows, really, with no end. I opened my ears, but no tin came out. Instead, limelight snuck in. With its velvet ropes and your ends and rejections. I opened my eyes, but no fine lines came out. Instead, raptures flew in. Pupils bigger than cats flew out. I opened my mouth, but no syllables came out. Instead, phonics lessons from the 80s flew in. PHs and OUGHs fight for space. Silent E arguing who gets to be the end of the line online. I opened my ears, but no silence came out. Instead, the sound of cotton candy flew in and out. Faster than you could say you got it at the fail. Too late, where you say too late. But as we all know, there's no the fail deep in the city.
Thank you so much. Stephanie.
There's a question, I think.
No.
We're not buzzing yet, but I love those. Thank you. And now I'll ask Cecil to please read.
Okay. Thank you. And I'll also point out that there are copies of this here if anybody wishes to take one. They're free. And this is from my essay. Can you all hear me? This is from my essay On a Line by Willie McTell that appeared in Beauty is a Verb, the gathering of disability writers. Blind Willie McTell's famous song Statesboro Blues, which some of you have heard, it's a song about that's his famous song. It's a song about the beauty of traveling also about race and sexuality, and some of that made it into the popular Allman Brothers cover, classic rock cover. Some of it did not. It's also about, Statesboro Blues is also about trains, and it includes the lines, Big 80 left Savannah, Lord and didn't stop, you ought to saw that colored fireman when he got them boilers hot. There's beauty to the railroad. In central Pennsylvania, in the first years of the new century, I trained as a railroad brakeman, and with others, I ran a tourist railroad centered in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania. I worked as a brakeman for a couple of years and then applied to be an engineer. An engineer is the person who drives the train. I passed the written exam and my student engineer's license came in the mail. In my other life then, I taught poetry at Penn State, one town over in State College, Pennsylvania. But this was funky Bellefonte. One day as we were making a run up to Pleasant Gap, my engineer, Steve, the man with whom I'd been paired for training, said, you run it for a while. And I did. The horn was a problem. It was a piece of rope that hung straight down next to the windshield, signaling a move forward, two short blasts, like bap, bap, or a move backwards, three short blasts, bap, bap, bap. Was easy, but then there's the signal for grade crossings. As all of you know, certainly, when a train comes to a grade crossing, the signal is two longs, a short, and a long. And the last long is to be prolonged or repeated until the engine or train is on the crossing. The problem for me is that the engineer should take the equipment through such a thing with his or her hand on the brake. Now that's fair enough, but a childhood accident had cost me my left arm several decades ago, and it's been a series of prosthetic devices ever since then. They've worked well, but the horn was a problem. There was a likelihood of slippage if I used my steel hook to grasp the brass brake lever, but if I kept my right hand on the brake, the dangling rope was hard to pluck with the hook from out of the air. So I went to Home Depot, bought an S-clip and a length of new rope, and added a loop, a long bow across the top of the windshield, an easier target for my hook. It's gross movement skills versus fine movement skills. It was less difficult for me to pull on that and make a joyous noise with, easier for me to pipe wildly down the valleys, as Whitman said. $2 worth of parts, now we're ADA compliant, said Steve. Is this disability? My mechanical man self ensconced in another machine moving across Pennsylvania, my cyborg, my amputee, my centaur, my rolling man, back to Whitman, type of the modern, emblem of motion and power, pulse of the continent. Cyborg? The dictionary embedded in my MacBook Pro says, fictional or hypothetic person whose physical abilities are extended beyond normal human limitations by mechanical elements built into the body. My hypothetical self. In a review of a novel by Stephen King, the reviewer says, King neatly figures the tropes of dismemberment. Dismemberment? I have no patience with neatness. We provided train service. We sold our service, including my labor at the throttle, or my labor as a brakeman on the ground at trackside. A ragtag gang of white kids stared once at Milesburg, Pennsylvania, as I waited for a coal train to pass before throwing the switch so we could take a load of paying customers to a restaurant 30 miles away in Tyrone, Pennsylvania. And one of them said, finally and definitively and loud enough for me to hear and not irreverently, Candyman. Now, hello. Do you know the movie? How many of you know the movie Candyman? Handful of people. Okay, it's an urban legend. It's a movie based on an urban legend, and Candyman was a murdered slave. He was lynched. He had it was one of the, he had in, had sex with the daughter of the plantation, and for that he was hunted down and killed. It was a consensual, you know, arrangement, but still, it's death. They pursued him. The lynch mob pursued him, and they cut off his hand and jammed a grappling hook into it, and then they killed him after that. And the deal is, if you say his name 5 times in a mirror, as you stare into the mirror, Candyman will appear and murder you. It's a great urban legend. And will murder you with his hook. Popular movie, 1990s. There's much wrong with the story. And our urban legends reveal the culture that we have come from. So you can cogitate on that one. So Candyman, as the children understood, Candyman. Is this disability? Candyman, the undying famous black monster of filmland, Tony Todd, the actor, with a hook for one hand. A monster is something else. Specifically, quoting Wikipedia probably, specifically an animal or plant departing greatly from the usual type, as by having too many limbs. How far is it from too many limbs to not enough? And what are normal human limitations? And what did he do to his white co-star, Virginia Madsen? Did he dismember her with his hook? The movie, based on urban legends and set in the Cabrini-Green projects, came out in 1992. I lost the arm in 1961. Normal human limitation would have me get by with one, and people do, but I've always had decent insurance, a middle-class trope, middle-class shield, so I come equipped with mid-range prosthetics that let me cook and drive and dress and frame doorways, bicycle to work, and operate trains. The idea one comes across is that phantom pain is the body's attempt to remember itself, and I find the idea precious and tedious both. On the railroad, I extended myself beyond the normal into the fictional, the synthetic, without resolution. Thank you.
And that was amazing. Jen, could we hear from you?
Sure.
And please perhaps place what you'll read in the context of Bellevue Literary Review. Thanks.
Absolutely. Hi, everyone. So I wanted to read one poem from the Bellevue Literary Review. It's not my own poem. It's written by Michelle Bombardier, who is a clinical neurological specialist and poet. Her specialties include autism and aphasia. And this was from our 2017 issue, winter 2017. It's called Aphasia Testing. Do 2 pounds of flour weigh more than one? Does the bulgur have any friends? If I'm not dead, am I quick? If words swim, will I drown? Will I drown friends if I pound? If I range without motion, is that jump? Will quick words bugle the brown fox? If a hand can't cup, can it ballast? Can a ballast weigh a prayer? If I pray without words, am I ceasing? If I yes without nod, am I no? Are the lights on in this room? Is 1 pound of flour heavier than 2? If I left my eye in my mouth, is it right? If I know what is nod, will it show? Is a hammer good for cutting wood? If I could cord my vocal, would I? Do I put my socks before my shoes? If I shush when I shatter, will I shine?
Extraordinary poem and beautiful reading. Thank you. I invite you to ask our panelists or respond to what they've just read. If you have anything you would like to say at this point, the floor is yours. Please feel free. Okay, we'll go forward. I think I'd like to kick things off with just a very broad, ask you to interact with the broadest way of thinking about our topic. And this is a very open-ended question, so please take it where you will. What is the literature of disability? How do you define it? And what is its history in the American literary canon? How has it been excluded from our national conversation? And historically, what has publishing's role been in enabling marginalization or resisting marginalization? Have fun.
Don't point that thing at me.
It might be good to ask you, where did you, at what point did you, in your own writing, come to grips with this area of literature? What prompted you, your personal experiences, and then maybe how those sync up with a larger tradition or movement or lack thereof?
I can be honest and say that now for the last couple of years, people asking me about my hearing loss, I realized this may come up with privileges that I have in terms of my disability, what I'm able to do. I can hear it, but I do need to rely on quotes sometimes to read people's lips. And I also make the joke to people who might remember Casey Kasem, the top 40 announcer from the 1980s. Anyway, he has this stereotypical low voice, Casey Kasem's top 40 countdown. And I would listen to that when I was in fourth grade and not really know why I was listening to it more than other stuff. Later, and also this happened with the grunge music and the classic rock music that usually have lower voices, which is what I can hear. Later I realized, oh, this is why I'm really paying attention to these voices, but as a kid I didn't know. And it may also have had to do with having parents who were working class and we weren't really knowledgeable about what to do about disability. It's just, I had a hearing problem occasionally came up. So I never really thought of myself as someone with a disability per se. It's a very weird thing to think about going backwards. I just remember sitting in the front and I definitely needed to hear a little bit closer. And for years, not until, this is really, really embarrassing, not until after college, did I know with the literary name on the television cell, this program has been closed captioned for the hearing impaired. And I never knew what that was. I was like, oh, there must be some weird technological thing. So I went through all these years of not getting Laverne and Shirley and Three's company with closed captions. Was it important to you? That's up for everyone to say, whatever Christy was saying in Three's company. But anyway, so then I ended up going back and not until living in New York where I think my hearing got worse because it's really loud, people asking me, and you know, offense to the movement or anything, you know, what do you think about disability and poetry? And if I write about it, and I never really wrote about it. I wrote about sound, and how sound is filtered through communication. And I think it came through subconsciously. This particular book came out with me wondering, how do we define the phrase being under sound? And that came about because I was listening to Eddie Butler from Pearl Jam years later and realizing, oh, I can hear his voice now, but no one else's, because he was so low. This was probably in 2005, 1 year after I moved to New York from Buffalo. And I was like, wait a minute, I'm not really hearing anyone else's voices but his. So I read somebody say, hey, Eddie Vedder is so low, the soundboard guys and women don't know how to deal with the sound on the soundboard. he's going below these decibels. And so anyway, at that point I started realizing, what would it mean to go under the sound? But I wasn't really thinking I had this hearing loss. So I feel like my question to it, I know part of the panel was like, are you about what it means? I think you can write about disability, but you may not always be saying, hello, I have this hearing loss, and this is how I deal with sound. But it comes through in kind of a subconscious way. And I mean, that's for a lot of things. So we're talking about in some of the specialized panels, how do we deal with our different identities? And if this is an ongoing topic of discussion. Are we defined by, or we're somebody who happens to write about sound, who can't hear high pitches? So it's a little bit of an experience with it, and I don't know if this brings up anything for the other panelists on how you write about your disability or not, or it comes out in subtle ways.
I can, you know, as you've been talking, it's the last thing that in particular touched me. I thought of a lot of things around this, but you know, if I heard you correctly, you're not saying that, generally speaking, that in poems you end up kind of raising your hand saying, I'm here I am disabled. And this relates to Allison's question at the beginning. You know, what is the community of disability in terms of writing? And I think that the Beauty is a Verb anthology speaks to that in some ways. There's a lot of different ways of it's kind of a ragtag army of people with it means many different things to many different people. There's no one solid definition. It's also incredibly open-ended. You know, are you really just, no, you're not really disabled. Nah, you know what, it's sure, come on in. You know, the door seems to be rather open. And that kind of ragtag army of writers who acknowledge disability, I think also works with individuals as well. There are many things that make us who we are. There are many groups that we belong to, groups of gender, groups of color, groups of region, and groups of body. And you can't talk about all those things, you know, together in a single poem or a single essay. Maybe the important thing is not to shrink from it. And that's and I think our culture encourages that in probably 1,000 different, you know, different ways every day. I'll stop there.
That's great.
Sure. Well, thinking about what you both are saying about, you know, how do I present myself in the space without always making this effort to say, well, it's coming from this disabled voice. You know, I, as an editor, became interested in the Bellevue Literary Review because I grew up in a home where my mother is an immigrant. She's never been formally educated, and she was a caregiver for my entire life. She's cared for children, and she's cared for adults. And so that was my experience of the world. And when I went to college, I entered a space, the writer's space, and a literary space that wasn't as representative of those experiences. And so that's entered into my writing in different ways, but it's also entered into my interest as an editor to find a way to welcome those voices into the Bellevue Literary Review, into No Dear, Small Anchor as well, and to look for them. And celebrate them. But it is something that's consistently on my mind, that this poem doesn't need to be about a disabled experience, right? It can simply evince those emotions. And I think it has, Stephanie, thinking about your poem, there were so many moments where I was laughing and I was sighing, and it really did. There was one line where you had written, you know, instead, I opened my ears, but no silence came out. Instead, the sound of cotton candy flew in and out faster than you could say it got at, you got it at the fair. And I thought texture and emotion is what I feel in this mm-hmm. moment. And I really love that. I really treasure that.
Thanks so much. This is a good time, I think, to invite responses.
Mike Northern. I'm one of the editors of Vivi as a Purpose. And we also have a follow-up short fiction anthology. But and I also edit work gathering an online journal for writers with disabilities. And this is an ad on advertisement, I know, but we have a table out there. I'm one member of the Disability Literature Consortium, and we represent five different journals that publish writers with disabilities. But just two things in response to what you were saying. One is, I know that when we published Beauty as a Verb, there were writers that wanted to be labeled as niche writers. So it's like, yeah, I don't want to really be in there, even though we wanted the work because it was really good. And so our attitude was, well, you know, if you don't want to identify that way, even though you write about it all the time, that's fine. But in word gathering, for example, if a writer has a disability and they don't want to say anything about it in their writing or in their bio or whatever, that's fine. It's still your writing. And so we publish it. Now, if you don't have a disability, that's a different story. But if you have a disability, you can either write because that's what you're writing about and that's what you want to say or that's what you want in your poetry. Or you can say, no, this is just me and this is writing, because still your voice coming through and you can't divorce yourself from that anyway. So I'm just putting that, and we did get a little bit of pushback because originally we limited ourselves more or less to physical disabilities because that was where I was working from. But when we did the anthology for fiction, we really opened it up a whole lot in terms of cognitive and developmental, you know, like you said, Asperger autism, and those kinds of things as well. So it's a huge umbrella, is all I can say. And you have to, Jim back here is one of the first people trying Jim Ferris, who tried to work with defining just what is disability poetry, what's it supposed to look and taste like, and what qualifies that, and you know, nobody has the answer for me, but
I think it would be a little hard to recap that for the recording.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I'm going to do my best. Thank you, Mike. Mike, in a very abbreviated way, and correct me if I've left out the most important points, but is alerting us to know that as a publisher, editor, he's very involved with this area of literature. Word gathering is one of your publications. And also there's a second anthology following Beauty as a Verb, and I believe it's a book of anthology of fiction. Is that
correct? It's called The Right Way to be Crippled and Naked.
The Right Way to be Crippled and Naked.
Right.
And he's also bringing to our attention the sort of paradoxical nature of wanting to shine a light on writings about disability or from a perspective of disability, and at the same time resisting the impulse for that to become a niche. So that, is that, have
yes,
I?
Yes.
And he also encourages us to visit his booth, which
yes.
sounds like a
yes.
fruitful adventure. And so thank you for that. What you say actually kind of leads me into a question where I'm going to ask our panelist.
Did I?
Yes.
I just want to spin off of that with a question, because I think it feels like you're dissected as a writer. You want the support and resources and a group, like there's so many other niche groups that have so much more support, it feels
mm-hmm.
like, and we have very little. Mm-hmm. I'm a military, I'm a veteran too, so I go over to the military vet groups. It's big. There's a lot of support there. There's a lot of people connecting in the writing world and of military veterans. And we don't have as much here. But I'm not only that. I'm not only disability, right? And so it's trying to find that balance of, you know, my voice across all of that. So I don't know if there's something that, but it's reflecting off of what you're saying, really.
Go ahead. Thank you. I didn't repeat what you said. I'm supposed to for the record. Can I see your name tag?
Rebecca.
Rebecca wants to respond to what Mike just said by offering the fact that there's so little support for her experience is that there's little support for writers writing about disability or from disability. She's also a veteran and has experienced a great deal more support for that. She's really trying to contextualize this within this sort of idea of niche writing. But the struggle in general to, you know, break through those boundaries, generate support, but also to be considered to have a larger impact. Is that it? Okay. Cecil's going to offer his thoughts.
Yeah, just something real quick, and that is that there is very slowly and very awkwardly, there is a support organization beginning called Zoglossia. Zoglossia, yeah. Zoeglossia. The board of directors includes Sheila Black, Jennifer Bartlett, myself. I'm involved in that. Connie Voisin, Charles Bernstein, and some other, few other people. So keep Googling it.
Can I add on to that?
Sure.
Because Jennifer can't get back and forth all the time. Mm-hmm. They're going to be doing two conferences here. One is going to be in San Antonio. I don't know the exact date, but the other one is at the University of Pennsylvania in August. And what they're trying to do is provide conferences and workshops and opportunities for writers with disabilities. I don't have the exact dates. I'm supposed to be on the panel there, but.
Yeah, well, no one has the exact dates.
Jennifer doesn't have the exact dates, but I mean, I know that they're working on it. So those are coming up. So as you said, Zoglossia's, check out the website.
Check out the website. The website's developing, you know, as we speak, as the organization, you know, continues to begin to exist.
I'd like to follow up really with, you've more or less really talked about this question I had, so I'm not going to tread that ground. I think it's a great way for us to think about these things, interrogate this question as we leave and, you know, struggle with it on our own and in community and through our creative work and our scholarly work. But I think I'd like to just bring up the question of audience because, you know, I think sometimes there can be a danger of being so balkanized by our issues that we are, you know, reflecting one another and talking to one another. It can occupy a large stage in our minds, but what is happening in the larger literary landscape? What opportunities do we open for students and MFA candidates and teachers to engage with this literature? And really, what the writing is going on, so what is the publisher's role? And in this competitive marketplace, how does a publisher, and I'm thinking of you, Jen, but I'd welcome anybody to jump in, or an organization, a support organization, what is your role really in one, you know, figuring out who that audience is and reaching that audience and then justifying the economics of it. It's complicated, necessary, but I'm wondering what your sense is of what's going on in the publishing world in terms of the topic we're talking about today.
Well, I'd like to speak by beginning with the history of the BLR. Are folks in this room familiar with the Bellevue Literary Review? Show of hands. Okay. So it was founded in 2000 by a teaching doctor at NYU Langone and Bellevue Hospital, Danielle Ofrey. And she conceived of the journal because she was bringing literature, works of fiction and poetry, into her teaching practice when she worked with medical students. And one of her goals was to teach doctors how to feel, how to empathize. empathize with their patients, and it emerged from a place where she felt very challenged by these things as she was learning to become a doctor herself. The journal has since grown and its audience has expanded, but a large number of its readers still remain doctors and medical practitioners. So we publish 2 issues a year. One issue is a contest issue. We invite a judge to select the works that we want to publish, and then the other issue is a theme issue. The last 2 issues, I've worked on 2 issues as the assistant poetry editor. The theme issue I worked on last year was family, and the theme issue we're currently working on is displacement. And the poetry editor, Jason Schneiderman, and I both think of the theme as just a kind of container, but we're always trying to push the boundaries of what is a family, right? How can we think about different kinds of families? How can we represent different kinds of displacement? And we are reading, of course, from our submissions. So with regard to then thinking about how disability writing then enters this larger space where it's interfacing with teaching doctors and medical students and, of course, other writers in the landscape, something that I think is wonderful that the BLR has done for many years is come up with study guides specifically for doctors, but then they've become conversation pieces, longer interviews that are available on the website. So creating other content that contextualizes the work for our readers that is available beyond the book itself, I find helpful for me as someone who also moves between different spaces, consistently being challenged by what my identity is and having to find it, as it sounds like you are, that these other components to publishing are economical and they are possible. A lot of our work is done solely by volunteers, so a lot of it is a labor of love, but I think we care about it very much.
Anything anybody would like to add at this point?
Well, I'm also curious too, you know, I'm here because I'd like to know what would be helpful beyond creating these other forms of content, so I'm just curious about Stephanie and Cecil, what you think, and then of course other audience members. As an editor, I'd like to know.
I just had a question about the creative differences between a lot of able-bodied editors or readers who need extra explanation about talking about disability or don't necessarily get the culture around disability, and how that can be conveyed better for an artist who identifies as disabled or talking about disability, so the content is still being maintained for an audience that is for the disabled community, mm-hmm. and not necessarily writing for the able-bodied community where you have to fill in that additional information, or changing a project that may be more journalism or technical for the disabled community, instead looking at something that's more memoir that's explaining and changing and trying to more cater towards the able-bodied community.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I'm going to try to summarize, but please interrupt me if I haven't captured what you've had to say. Our question is addressing the difference, creative differences between able-bodied editors and readers who might need additional explanation. And it seems to me, just on this topic of audience, engaging those readers but not diluting the work itself so that the disabled community is still addressed. So it seems as though you're asking about, can you accomplish both things, or how do you approach the writing in terms of being published in a journal?
It's that, and also looking at the disabled community is a reading community and audience in and of itself, so mm-hmm. not having to write for the able-bodied community and recognizing there's a need for other kinds of publications out there that don't specifically have all the extra info that an able-bodied reader might need.
Okay.
So you're speaking and writing for right. a different audience.
Right.
and the validity of writing specifically for a community of disabled readers and writers, and that there's a need for other publications that don't necessarily privilege the able-bodied community. It would be great if our panelists care to respond to that. Excellent point. Thank you.
All right. And around that, I suppose what I think of first, is since I've been an editor, I've been a publisher, the variety of publications that are that are out there. But I also think of the real first thing I think of is my friend, the poet Harriet Mullen. Some of you know who she is. And she's a poet. We have many identities. African American poet, experimental poet, UCLA professor, preacher's daughter from Texas. All of that, works in the poems. And what she says is that when she gives readings in public, and there's a lot of stuff in her books, in her poems. The most famous one is probably called "Sleeping with the Dictionary," a book that I will recommend to all of you because it's a brilliant book. And she says that when she gives readings to a large, diverse group of people, different people in the audience or different groups in the audience laugh and respond to different things, and in that way, and the poems kind of cover the waterfront in that way, and the particular hell of writing, as far as I can tell, is that one writes to put it crudely, to two groups, the group of oneself. Mm-hmm. You write to please yourself. I certainly do. And also to what you write in public. Both of those things at the same time. And how as a writer, you or I constitute the public is kind of up to us. If there's opaque things, and I value opacity. I don't mean to be obscure, but I'm writing for myself. And if you can understand it, that's great. If you don't, that's there's other stuff as well. So that kind of the whole unbalance of a piece of literature, the parts that don't quite hold together, are, I think, how literature fails is what makes literature great. It's the failures. Does that make any sense?
Love that.
Okay.
Please feel free to respond here in our panel and from our small community here in the audience. And Mike, you had something to say?
I don't want to monopolize things, but to your point about the ableism in the general public with editors, there's a writer, John Lee Clark, who's a deaf-blind writer, and he was kind of head of the pro-tactile movement. Mm. And his point of view is, look, I send in things all over to editors, and I get rejected for various reasons. And a lot of it has to do because they want me to write for an able-bodied audience that doesn't really understand what I'm talking about. And damn it, I'm sick and tired of that. I'm going to write for the people. Somebody needs to write for the people in a way that I don't have to lay all the groundwork for them, but we're kind of on the same wavelength. And so, I don't know where this is going, really, but there is kind of that shift a little bit. Is like, yeah, we know we're out there, but why do we have to be the ones to accommodate you all the time? Mm-hmm. Why don't you turn around and accommodate us and try to listen in to us, and you be the ones that have to figure out what we're talking about.
So, just to repeat this for the recording, and then we'll go to you, Rebecca. Thank you. Mike pointed to a writer, John Lee Clark. He said he's blind.
deafblind. Yeah.
He's deaf and blind, and he submits his work to many journals, but feels that often the rejections come because the editors want him to write for an able-bodied audience. Question is, why should we accommodate them? Why is the direction not going opposite that? And I'm just going to add my own little comment to that, because it's somewhat of a rhetorical question, but really a real one. And that is, how do these editors know what able-bodied audiences want to read, what points of view they already have, in what ways everyone self-identifies? Everyone is a complicated, socially and biologically constructed being. So these assumptions are coming from a kind of oppressive, often white male, but other, basically an inherited patriarchal point of view, perhaps. So I think those assumptions need to be, somehow challenged at a fundamental level, because who is your audience? Your audience could be very, very much more diverse than you imagine. So, Rebecca, you had a comment too.
Yeah, this came up in a creative nonfiction class at our MFA program. And it was really interesting because, nonfiction writers, they're talking about themselves. They're the narrator. And somebody had written something and didn't explain, and everybody was like cheering that on. And it's about trusting your audience that they'll take some time to look something up that they don't understand, and I think we have to write to that too, and let them, because when they're interested, if it's engaging and they're interested, they're gonna do the work. Sometimes it doesn't matter if they completely understand the medical, technical, terminal procedure that's going on, they just know it's there and it's part of the journey. So I love that that came up, because I think it takes a lot of onus out of trying to explain, quantify everything in your writing. It takes the reader out of the dream of the story. And I personally just don't do the explanation, because I want them in the dream. I want them in the story.
So to try to summarize your beautifully expressed comment, which I won't do justice to, is as a nonfiction writer, Rebecca wants to trust her audience to be interested to look things up, go on that journey with the writer, not take them out of the dream of the writing, and that if the writing engages, that individual is going to go on that journey with you, regardless of the knowledge base of the experience you're writing from. And so did I capture that? I think
I think it's true, like in military writing, I'll write stories from that space. People don't understand the jargon.
Yeah.
I don't bother explain. I mean, I give them enough, right? I think they're very similar.
Right.
And so those voices are crossing and leading. And I think it's the same thing. You start getting technical and they're like, I don't care anymore.
Don't worry about the technical language and the jargon if the writing is there. You can trust your audience to engage with it. I'm going to actually follow up with you. Can't see your name.
Suzanne,
thank you. You had something to say, and then there's a gentleman next to her across the aisle. Thanks.
My question, though, still is, how do you approach editors and publications to say this content that is different, that you haven't published before, is relevant and necessary to a different audience than you're catering to help push the envelope and push publishing in a different direction than has been catered to able-bodied readers? So how do you keep pushing that envelope and saying, this information, this story, this content, in whatever form it is, we have readers, there's a reason for this work and it's necessary. So how do you approach those editors to take that work?
So the question, I'm sorry, I forget your name.
Suzanne.
Thank you, Suzanne. How do you approach editors and publishers, letting them know that this content you're submitting is necessary? Is necessary to perhaps a different audience from the audience they're generally accustomed to addressing or speaking with,
And how do writers keep pushing that envelope, that there's a reason for this work? I'm wondering if our panelists care to respond.
Sure. I can only speak to my sensibilities as an editor and the way that Jason and I think about the poems as we select them. The last thing we want to do is identify someone in the way that they don't want to be seen, right? And we don't want to offend anyone. So we welcome in the cover letters biographical information. We welcome context for the work, of course, but we don't require it. And thinking to the theme issues that we put together, they're a place for us to subvert the theme, right? And so when we are making those selections, Jason and I have long discussions about the formal qualities of the poem. What is the line doing? What is this language doing? Are we being moved in this way? And we get very far removed from, you know, the technical. Is this explaining enough? Is it not? And we're so not invested in that because we want the writer to bring their perspective and their story to the page. To that end, I will say this is an example that's sort of outside of our conversation, but a writer who's Vietnamese-American had submitted a poem about his grandmother and referred to her as grandmother in Vietnamese in the poem, and then comma, grandmother in English, and that invited us to have a conversation with this writer to ask, you know, would you be interested, what do you think of removing the word grandmother in English from the poem because of the improved formal qualities of the sound of the poem if you read it without? And this writer wrote back to us to say, I was concerned that my reader or your readers wouldn't understand what this term meant, and I'm perfectly fine letting it go. And especially if you think that it's important that, you know, it improves the quality of the poem, the sound of the poem, and also that, you know, Jason and I feel there's Google. If you want to know what it is, Google it, you know. And I think, Cecil, that speaks to your value of opacity. Yes. We value that very much as editors, and we want to champion that.
Yeah, just to go on with Jen's point. I'm tossed back to Langston Hughes and to The Negro Artist and the Racial Mountain, which I believe was published in 1920. And the end of, and it's an essay that I'm referencing in some other work that I'm doing right now. So it's very much on my mind. And at the end of it, you know, he says, we younger black writers, stand on the mountaintop and shout our names. If black people don't like what we're saying, that's okay. If white people, you know, the people who control the publishing, don't like what we're saying, that's okay too. And so one finds one's own niches, as it will. And speaking as an editor, I've been an editor. Where does one wish to get published? You know, what's the journal that you wanna be in? I recall my sister asking me, my sister who's not in the life as we are, asking me if I think I'll ever be a successful writer. And her idea of being a successful writer is being in the New Yorker. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be in the New Yorker. I don't care what, you know, I like the cartoons. And, you know, it's subscribe. I like many of the articles, but the poetry, the fiction, yeah. So, you know, it's not, if I'm an exploratory writer, as I hope, and I hope that's a, you know, that's something that many of you can hear as a, you know, as like a vocation. Who do you want to be in with? You know, what other writers, able-bodied, disabled, white, black, Asian, you know, queer, straight, what group of writers do you wish to be a part of? So that's a way to go. I'll stop.
Stephanie, you have something to say?
I want to go back to something that you said, Cecil, about opaque things and opacity. And I do think, you know, for example, when I wrote this poem, I hope you might know, but no, Sam cannot. I mean, I'm probably thinking of the experience of talking with people, and I have to listen for a moment, digest the information before I say something, which results a little bit in time delay sometimes. Was I thinking and never always hearing everything, and I'm upset about that? Or, for example, then wanting to acknowledge my disability, no. But because, and maybe because of my hearing loss, I've always been drawn to language poetry, which is sometimes quote-unquote just and popular poetry. But I was interested in the breaking of the language and how it moves on the page, which for me sometimes reminds me of a disjunctive conversation when I miss things. But coming back to what you said, and then, okay, you can read this poem, yeah, I'm about to say something, but I didn't quite say it fast, and if someone else started talking, and just reading their lips, something else happened. In those moments, what happened, okay, I'm thinking of a sound like cotton candy. If you get this poem as somebody who has a hearing loss, that's pretty, that's fine. If you get it because you're able-bodied, and you're like, oh, this happens when I'm nervous, when I'm talking to people, and I don't know what I'm going to say, that's fine. I didn't really have an intent, but I was simply really because of the experience. I'm not shying away from saying, hey, I'm hearing loss. Sometimes I remember putting my bio, Stephanie, really deals with queerness, disability, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes I forget to put that because of whatever word count. But I do think, coming back to what you said earlier, different writers, you can get different things from it. I have mentioned hammers and anvils in the ear, the little bones, maybe once in this book. If someone doesn't know that and you're really thinking of a real hammer, they can go back to the context and they can Google it.
Yes.
I didn't really know what the hammer and anvil was until much later because I had such a delayed understanding because of maybe a less education of my family. So I do think, you can mention it, not mention it. People get it and apply the experience where they learn something new. They read this whole thing and say, wait a minute, did I just read something? If this person doesn't have a lot of hearing? Sometimes I don't mind the surprise. But I mean, it has changed about over the past number of years. You can Google stuff now, like military coding, code words. I mean, when I teach English composition, sometimes I teach a number of very recent veterans. And I do see that language. And I don't know what it means. I do Google it. I do get on this like discussion list that are very intimate just because the word pops up. And I kind of like that they didn't explain it because it brings me into their world. Sure, I had to pause for a moment, but it probably feels more real to the community who's experienced that there hasn't been an explanation. This word means whatever, because that pause can feel less authentic, perhaps. You would hope that maybe editors would understand that. I mean, it's different now with the ease of Google. So I think the opaque things can sometimes really work out in a creative way in everyone's favor.
Mm-hmm. That was wonderful. Thank you. I'm wanting to alert all of us that we have about 4 minutes. And before I forget, I know that Stephanie has brought a few copies of her books. If you would like to buy a copy, have her sign one, if you can just do that outside the doors so that we can accommodate the next panel, that would be great. And I hope you'll explore Bellevue Literary Review. I'm assuming you're represented here at the book fair. And are your books represented here at the book fair?
One of my books is available at the Omnidon booth. That's where you can find it.
Also, I hope you'll read everybody's books, which are marvelous and complex and deep and resonant. And because we have 3 minutes, I will take one last comment or question before we conclude. And I thank everyone for your participation and wonderful attention and really excellent comments and questions. Sir, did you raise your hand earlier?
I did.
Do you want to?
The moment has passed.
Okay.
I mean, there is one thing that I've been thinking about, this question about what to explain and what not to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking particularly about a poem. I have been appointed as the poet laureate of Lucas County, Ohio,
Toledo.
And the now new mayor, before he was sworn into office, somebody from his staff asked me if I would read a poem at the swearing-in ceremony. And I said, sure. And I was thinking, I'll pull something off of the shelf. I'll give them a little Yeats or Auden or something. And that night, I found myself kind of playing with a Latin phrase that's on the seal of the city of Toledo. That I'm sure triggered something from my studying Latin when I was in high school online. And a part of this question of translation became a part of what was useful to play with in the poem. But one of the things that I found really